Data Mesh Radio is provided as a free community resource from DataStax. Welcome to Data Mesh Radio, produced and hosted by Scott Hurlman, the founder of the Data Mesh Learning Community. Data Mesh Radio is a vendor-independent resource for learning more about Data Mesh. Let's jump in. Bottom line up front, what will you hear about and learn about in this episode? I interviewed Khan Chow, lead architect for the Data Mesh Initiative at Northern Trust. Let's start with the background first. Northern Trust has been moving forward with Data Mesh for about 7 months as part of their high-level digital transformation initiative. On the data side, they had previously focused on data virtualization and data federation, but it was not delivering the results that they had wanted. They were too IT/technology focused. Instead of centering on getting the data to consumers in a usable, consumable format, it was also not as scalable as they wanted. It was taking 2 to 3 months to launch each new data service. They did not have great information on who was consuming the data and why. Lineage was also an issue. Northern Trust decided on going down their data mesh path to take a pragmatic approach, such as not pushing all aspects of data ownership fully left. Adavinta took a similar approach, even if the implementation details were very different. Khan and team were focused on finding a happy balance on data product SLAs and quality. Improvement was crucial, but good and done is better than perfect and just a few more weeks/months. Khan talked about the need for exec buy-in before heading down the data mesh path. They got that exec buy-in by proving that the total cost of ownership, or TCO, of the data was quite high, as the consumers had to do a lot of work to get the data to a usable format. It was not easy to prove, though, as a word of caution. For their proof of concept for data mesh, they set a timeline of 3 sprints, which was 9 total weeks. They needed to prove value by then or data mesh would be a tough sell internally. Khan talked about the need to sell data mesh as a paradigm shift, get people out of technology-focused thinking, which is kind of what led them down that data virtualization and data federation path that wasn't paying off for them. When speaking internally, the business people, you know, really the domains, were very excited to participate if it meant that they could get quality data. Some of the IT/data engineering folks were harder to convince. It was especially hard to get them to shed layers of not very useful technology. A common pushback was kind of, but my toys. Some IT teams were easier to convince as they had felt the impact of a few too many middle of the night data downtime incidents. Other teams hadn't felt that pain, so they were harder to win over. There was also the incentive of additional possibilities. Data mesh meant that these teams could do things that they couldn't do before. Khan talked about the 80-20 rule. You know, I'm seeing this in a lot of places. Make the platform the easy and right path for 80% of the use cases. Don't try to paint too much of the white space. Don't try and paint too much in the corners because you'll be spending all of your time focused on those corner cases instead of improving it for the vast majority of users. Focused on making things easy to configure, basically what transformations do you want to do? And then it automatically provisions the pipelines for the teams. Their goal was to make it easy to make good progress quickly. Their time to initial deploy went from 2 to 3 months per data service when they were doing the data virtualization and data federation route to 2 to 3 weeks to per data product. And they hope to drive it down even further. So that's about, you know, a 75% reduction. A big focus and a key driver for Northern Trust has been building muscle and learning evolving along the way. It's important to evolve quickly and not build muscle in the wrong way. When you think about sports and you think about training and things like that, if you do things the wrong way repeatedly, that becomes ingrained. And that's bad because it's hard to kind of get yourself out of that mode. But you also need to make failure okay. You should look to make it easy to fail fast, measure, and adjust. Northern Trust is still in the early days of figuring out interoperability between data products. It's more of an art than a science. You know, Khan believes that bitemporality is more important right now than interoperability. But the Northern Trust team understands that interoperability is important as it allows, one, more easily sharing data from acquired companies, and two, leveraging of data from legacy systems. For Khan, he really emphasized that you have to be passionate about making data better to do a good job implementing data mesh. And it is definitely a journey, so you need patience and vision. Also, each journey is unique. You can't just copy-paste from another organization as much as a lot of us want to do that. So heck yes, say that with me again one more time. Each journey is unique. You can't copy-paste from another organization. This is another really good interview in our series of user journey stories, and I think you'll really enjoy it and get a lot out of it. With that bottom line up front done, let's go ahead and jump into this interview. All right, very excited for this episode today. I've got Khan Chow here, who is the lead architect for the Data Mesh initiative at Northern Trust. And, you know, we've been kind of exchanging some context back and forth previously as well. And I think this is a really good journey to share, especially because we've got, it's a company that's not as seen as cutting edge. I think they have really modernized a lot of what they've been doing over the last few years. I think the more that you look at into things under the covers, they have been modernizing a lot more than I think people might expect for kind of a company in the financial services space that isn't an investment bank. But I think this will help a lot of people as well to navigate some of those challenges with data mesh between the legacy aspects of a company that's been doing stuff and been very, very successful over many decades. And so how can we set that up to change and change in such a way that it's not an abrupt change and we're throwing out the baby with the bathwater and that we're keeping kind of what's been functioning. So with that, if you don't mind, if you could give a little bit of an intro to yourself and your background, and then we can jump into the questions.
Yeah. Hey, Scott. Glad to be here. And finally, we get to talk. Lots of things that we have been done in the past year and a half, I'd like to share with you and the audience. I'm with Northern Trust as a lead architect for the Data Mesh Initiative that we started about 7 months ago. The initiative is part of the digital transformation that our executive are, building and helping to transform our company into a much more data-driven culture. I can talk with you about a little bit of the journey because part of this is we have done a lot of work in terms of transforming the company from a lot of IT project-based kind of projects into a more domain fit for purpose kind of data for consumption, for analytics, for reporting, especially with regulatory reporting. But the analytics space is very, very hot right now as multiple teams are building out various models to help with creating much more innovative products for our variety of clients, from institutional to wealth clients. So it's an exciting space to be able to start working on creating more products, more new ideas that we can help you know, help the clients getting the most for their services.
Yeah, and I think that's great. I think there's lots of different ways that we could jump into that conversation, but I think one good way might be maybe if you could share some stuff about how you got started, or where were some roadblocks that you might have faced early on, and how you got over those, and how you might even rethink how you've done them if there were patterns where you said, hey, we went down this and it wasn't a great path, or what you think could be helpful for others that would be looking to do the same.
Yeah, that's a good starting point. When I first came to Northern Trust, I'm part of this Rapid Solution Group that, and the purpose, of course, is to provide values to business, right? So we started out with all these different data platforms, starting with the data virtualization, data federation technologies to some kind of leave the data where it is and just try to pull them on demand and provide and ship the data for consumption to use. That data virtualization is pretty interesting. I know you have another podcast with someone to talk about that. And I know that might be another topic, but that's how I started out, realizing that a lot of the things we do at the bank has been a lot more, you know, microservices, distributed system, more IT focused than trying to get the data to the consumers. So a few years into that, we start realizing that, hey, we're not getting data to the consumer fast enough. So a little bit of fast forward to 2020 is we start realizing that, well, we create a lot of microservices, we're creating a lot of, data virtualization products and fit for purpose, but it's not quite as meeting all the needs of the consumers, right? Because the number of use cases, the number of ways that people want to use the data now just kind of exploded. They want to use the data so many ways. So we quickly realized that what we have done is not as scalable as we like. And to be able to scale and to create a data-driven culture so that not every time we build a service, it would take 2 months or 3 months to build, to create data that can be understood, right, identifiable, that can be consumed, that can be used for a variety of purposes, to create derivative products that other people might use. Those are the journey that we haven't got that far yet, right? We're still kind of trying to figure out to deliver data to one place, but then we don't really know who's using the data, how much of that being used, and why are they using it, right? And whether they still want to use it or not. So those are the questions that we're trying to figure out. And some of the answer come back was the data quality wasn't good.
Yeah, that's a very common thing of, okay, you delivered me something, but it wasn't usable, it wasn't trustable. So it might be even that quality was good, but it wasn't actually structured the way they wanted it, or the quality wasn't measured in such a way where they felt they could trust it, right? So It may be that the quality actually was there, but that you couldn't prove to them that the quality was there, and people are used to data quality being bad. And so there's that scar tissue, even if you are doing it great. So,
And that's where the lineage is, right? Scott, I mean, you look at the data, where's the provenance part of it? But people don't understand after you have so many IT teams touching the data through so many layers, and you go back and ask them, hey, what do you do with this data? Well, so it's been there all this time. I'm just maintaining it. Well, that's not a good answer, right? So then you go back upstream to maybe two or three more layers and then start realizing that the data has been, the rules are being captured at different places, multiple services, multiple messaging system involved, and it's difficult to do it. So what we're trying to do say now is, hey, if you are the data owner and the custodian of that data, right, why don't you just publish it? And if you have any, you can stand behind it, you can be accountable. And if people have questions, you're the one that can answer because nobody else can. Right.
Yeah.
So that's what the spirit of data mesh is about. At least one part of it is that what we're trying to implement.
Yeah. And have that communication about who is using what data and why. Right. And so that person publishing it, you're not just saying you're publishing into a void, that you create that conversation where you're like, here's why you're publishing it. Here's who's using it. Here's how they're using it. Like, we're going to get you in a room and we're not going to do IT or data engineering or whatever org you've got being the communication channel, because then you're playing, you know, telephone, you're and the message gets garbled between what the consumers want and what the producers have and what they can produce and give over. And it becomes a real challenge. I really liked what you said of, you had a lot of IT focused projects on getting the data to the consumers, but not actually what they wanted, right? I think that's a key understanding of Data Mesh. It's that, hey, we're shipping you the data. It's like, but it's not what we want. It's not what we can use. It's not how we can understand it. We can't trust it. We can't, like, so exactly what you're talking about of creating this, like, a product and a service and that type of thing. It's not just that you're serving out data. It's that you're serving out the quality and the repeatability that somebody can come back and say, I am going to be able to run this query again. And that I don't have to just, you know, trust this as a one-off dump of data. So I really like that. Where would you say...
And Scott, just real quick, because you have another episode and I really enjoy it, is IT people loves to refactor, love to hydrate all this stuff into something that, hey, I know that's what you want, but I'm going to refactor and create a generic, right? So now you have all these generic things that are not exactly what people want, because a lot of these business, they want data shaped the way it is so that's convenient and useful for them, right? And that is the hard part, is why IT loves to do refactoring, because we are in a business of making, create efficiency. But that's another topic by itself. Just it's not exactly what they want, but they under, yeah, the requirement was there, but the delivery is a lot more IT-centric thinking than business thinking, right? Giving them what they want versus what we want.
Yeah. How much abstraction is good, because it does create that efficiency, and how much is over-normalizing versus not? And I think it's a sliding scale every single time. Yeah. Like, there isn't an answer. That's a very good point. So if somebody were kind of in the position that you were of, you know, where you were focused on sharing this information, but it just wasn't having the same impact that the consumers wanted. Like, where do you think is a good place to start? Where is that with, you know, Angelo Martelli from Van der Lande had talked about, he wanted to prove there was a problem. So he went out there and he proved there was a problem. Max Schulze had talked about, well, we just wanted to kind of get ourselves out of the way. And, you know, we had one-on-one conversations. And so, you know, but that's not scalable. So then we created ways to kind of scale those. But like, everybody's is a little bit different. What did you think was the thing that really got you moving? Because there are so many potential roadblocks. There's so many ways you can get in your own way with Data Mesh. So what was the thing that really got it all moving? Was it the exact buy-in? Was it the, you know, creating a framework for collaboration instead of your, you know, kind of pub sub of you just consume what I publish and that's the way it is? Or like, how did you do that?
Yeah, definitely executive buy-in is one very good reason, but this is a prerequisite, right? What got us going was that it wasn't scalable, what we're doing, because I think a lot of challenges is, even though we may deliver something that the consumer wants, it's not exactly, so there's still a lot of work downstream for them to massage the data, right? It could go into a spreadsheet, it could go into some other tool, and business have to do some more work to really make the data usable. So now you start having a long latency, right, of getting data to the hands of consumers, and they still have to do some more work to get there. So the total cost of ownership is kind of not quite represented, but by the time people realize that the total cost of ownership includes downstream work, then they start realizing that, hey, we need a better way to do this. So I think those are the things that really drive every initiative in any company, right? Is the what is the actual total cost of ownership on something like this? When we build something that requires a lot more high touches at the right side of it.
Did you have any way of measuring that, you know, to me, that can be such a nebulous concept, because I totally get exactly what you're saying. But if somebody's not, if somebody's bought in, then they would say, yes, yes, I get it. But if somebody's not bought in, is there a way to kind of show them that, hey, is it to talk to the different consumers and say, hey, explain to me what you do after you access the data, you know, and that we can prove it's not scalable and repeatable and trustable and all that?
Yeah, I think in some cases it's easier than the other when there's more transparency. In some cases, it's not as easy. But I guess, you know, if you go into a budget meeting and you suddenly realize that your software doesn't get past 1.0, you kind of know that the business is not happy, and that's where you have to start thinking about how to service them better. Yeah, I don't have a good answer there, Scott. Part of it is there's multiple, you know, people involved. To get all the figures together is a little bit challenging, I guess, in any large organization.
Yeah, it's trying to figure out what challenge are we actually trying to solve. It's difficult because it's like, oh, well, we want to deploy a data mesh. Well, why? And it's like that scalability and agility you mentioned, right? Like I think that's really crucial. So you were talking about that it was taking you 2 to 3 months to create a service. Obviously, you know, kind of re-architecting the way that you do is going to kind of delay things at the general level for a bit. But like, how did you start to go about your POC? Like, how did you choose where you wanted to kind of start with this, and what was your scope there?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So when we started out, we'll talk about data mesh POC, right?
Yes, the pilot. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. You know, the thing we want to do is find out if it's a better way of doing things than what we had mm-hmm. before. So it has to be fail fast, right? When we started out, we said we're going to do this in, you know, 3 sprints, right? And we're going to know right away by the end of the 3rd sprint that this is working or not. And then we set a number of principles, right? What are the principles that we are really after? Can we create... We're not trying to buoy the ocean, of course, right? But we have to figure out how we can get value out of something like this. Can we weave one thread through this whole new data mesh construct to do it? And what we found out pretty quickly is the data mesh is not a technology. And this is about, you know, a year ago, right? We used to say it's not a technology thing. It's both a small part of it is technology. The larger part of it is the paradigm shift in thinking, right? Embracing the data, embracing the products, and treat data product as our first class corporate asset that we are responsible for describing it and making it, you know, usable and consumable by consumer. That means if we're going to put something out there, we're going to stand behind it. If we're going to put something out there, it's going to have quality that people know how to use it. So our POC described that, right? If we're going to do this in 3 weeks, we're going to make it usable by an actual use case of something that we want to do. And that's what we did. I'm sorry, not 3 weeks, 3 sprints, which is every sprint's about 3 weeks. So that's about nine weeks or so that we know exactly how it's going to pan out. So starting out with something like that, understand the challenges that we're facing, because it's not all about technology. It's about changing the mindset and really get people identify the owners, the custodians, the stewards of the data, so that they can put their names to the jerseys, right? If there's a challenge, you got to know who to go and talk to. Those are the things that we have to do early and upfront. And that's the only way that would be successful. And that's exactly what we did, was to do all of that initial legwork to set the principles, to set the goals of the POC.
Yeah, and I think one thing that you said in there, it can be misinterpreted, which is that data products are assets. I fully agree with you. It's that what Jamak has said is stop trying to manage data as an asset, because then you're just trying to collect data and you're just trying to amass as much data as you are, instead of a product is, does it delight the consumer, right? Like that's what you're trying to drive towards, is that people are using this and that they find it useful, and that, but that if you are creating good data products, they are an asset. They are of significant value to the company. So it's not that the data itself is the asset. It's that the data products become the asset. So I think that's a very crucial point that you made.
Yeah. It's a high value asset, right? What is a high value asset, right? Not just some ingredients or events or things. Events are good too, right? It can be a product if you view it and use it properly. But yeah, it's high value products that people want to use. That's the key thing.
Yeah. Well, you've got to have that return on investment, right? Data mesh is an investment.
Absolutely.
It's an investment in somewhat in the technology and things, but it's a big investment in the people and the process side of kind of shifting this, and whether you're hiring new people or you're retraining them or you're refocusing them, it's an investment. So I agree very much with that. You were talking about this is a big paradigm shift, right? Like, this is not the way companies have thought about delivering data. So on which side do you think was the more difficult shift? Was it on the consumer side, or I presume that the producer side, to get them kind of bought in on this? And how did you work with them?
Okay. Well, I can answer the first question pretty quickly. The second one is a little bit more involved. Yeah. The first question is, okay, which side is easier? Definitely business, right? We have this whole business-driven IT-enabled idea of when we start out with a mesh is it has to be business-driven. And business just sign up. Man, they just sign up. They just say, yep, I'm on this because I want good data. I want data that I could use for analytics. I want data that I can create more uses out of it. So yeah, that's the first thing they do. You go to business, then they all sign up. The IT side, you know, is more challenging because we have so many technologies, and it's not just our company, but I think a lot of companies we have, when you talk about full tech stack, right, kind of work that we used to do, every project, every team we go to, they have a different stack, right? Over 20 years now, it used to be .NET back then, and then Java architecture, then going to SOA, and then, you know, ESB, and then you go to microservices, and then all the vendor tools, everything is so different. So getting IT teams to start thinking about how do we shed some of these layers, right, and move to the left as much as possible, it become a very difficult exercise because there's so much rules. There's so many things been built. There's so much technical debt that we have done over the years that taking the effort to do it would be challenging. So the approach we took, and I know Scott and everybody, you know, listening, you know that this is a journey, and you know that the messaging over time we start changing a little bit, making it more meaningful within your company, right? Not every company has the same message when it comes to this. Our company has done the messaging and refined it over the months and weeks that, hey, you know, we've got to take a pragmatic approach to a lot of this. If we could not go all the way to the left, we can't find somewhere, right, that somewhere to the left that would be more manageable, something that we can bite into it and then start a process there. And knowing in a year or two down the road, we're going to try to create more base products out of that. So we start having something that hey, this is a good enough product with enough ownership and custodian that we have some guarantee of data quality and service level agreements that we can start with that. So that is how we start. And to find that happy point is very challenging with a diverse set of technologies and management teams that we have.
Yeah, I mean, I fully agree. I wish there were a framework where you could just go and here is how you find that happy point. But I know it's different in every single case and things like that. But how did you work with, like, was there a key message that you took outside of, like, just kind of, was it just be pragmatic? We're not going to boil the ocean. We're not going to change everything on you, you know, just willy-nilly, just kind of tomorrow we're doing this new approach, you know, that doesn't ever work. How did you get the IT teams to start to feel comfortable that this was a good approach when it is so different from the way a lot of people have done stuff historically?
Yeah. Some IT teams, they recognize the issue right away because they live that every day. So they help us basically say, hey, can we do it this way? So the message has been, how can you make my life easier so I don't have to get up at midnight and join the SWAT car, right, and figure out what's wrong with the data? So they love that, those IT teams that have lived through the challenges of data quality and data, the operation size of the data, they're very quick to jump on. So our messaging for those group is, hey, this is going to make your life easier, right? And you're going to be able to do things that you haven't been able to do before. Because there's much more data products that you can build and make, you know, creating a more value added to your organization. And those are the groups that see it right away. There are certain groups that are a little bit harder to get that message through, partly because it's working, right? If it works, why would I want to break this window and rebuild it, kind of thing? So it's the messaging has been a little bit harder to craft. I tell you, I'm not in that space because I'm more on the build side of the data mesh architecture, the technical architecture. But we have teams that work on data strategy, data product, and enablement team. And by the way, you know, this shouldn't be just a single team, right? This should be a collaborative effort of strategy team, of the support and operation teams, and then data engineering teams and data science and the business. There should be four or five teams that help with the governance, that help with the messaging part of it. So I usually work with all those teams and help deliver the message. The key thing is to be consistent of the messaging. And I think that has been not always the case as we've gone through this journey, but it's getting a lot clearer now that we are 7-8 months into it. In term of implementation and rolling it out, we're 7 or 8 months into it. So the messaging has been a lot better. But it's all about what is the value, right? How it's going to make you feel better and look better, and how does it make your business, you know, be able to do things. And of course, with that, then more funding to do all the stuff that you haven't been able to get to.
And when you're talking about IT, some people if they've moved especially to microservices, they don't consider the application developers to be IT. Are you including the application developers in that IT group, or are they part of the business? Just because, you know, a lot of people are finding it's difficult to get the application developers interested in doing this. But I just want to make sure that we're because every company calls different people in different groups and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I tend to identify the data engineering team is the IT side, right? Because I'm in the data space. So I know there are different levels of different application and portal and mobile and all that stuff, which is a little bit outside of my purview at the moment. My job is to get source data, right? Useful data to get on the mesh. So usually I look at data engineering and the operation side of it. So the data engineering, the guys that know, really know software engineering, really, really know distributed computing, really know how to take the technologies and help flow the data through these pipelines, right? And the operations guys, the guys that can really support it, right? And make harden it and enable them to keep this thing up and running, right? The five nines or the things that we do. Northern Trust is very has a very reliable capability when it comes to going to production. I mean, if you're not in the nines, we're not going to do it. So it's imperative that we have we help the operation team stay at that level, and that's where most of my work has been with those two groups on the left side.
Yeah, that's interesting, because when you said that the business people were really excited, sometimes that can mean that the business people only are excited because they're consuming versus they're also producing. But then we're seeing a lot of business folks are, you know, domains and things are saying, oh, well, we hadn't really looked at our data in the same way. And so, you know, somebody else telling us that this is how they want to consume our data made us rethink the way we were looking at our data. And so it helped us as well from that standpoint. But, you know, some business sides are just like, I want to consume all the other businesses' data and I don't want to produce it myself. So that can be a little bit of a frustrating conversation. But, you know, you talked about these different teams collaborating as well to drive buy-in. But you talked previously about that you're kind of helping the teams to get the data and source that data, as well as kind of helping to build the actual platform side of it. Like, how do we actually build this to be a scalable thing so we're not building custom one-off thing? You know, you talked about that 2 to 3 months for each data service, and that's a custom one-off versus repeatability. So lots of different pathways we could go down there, but is there one that you find that you think would be interesting to kind of dig further into?
Yeah. It is, because, as you know, there's so many ways to tackle this data mesh idea. Right? what kind of technologies, what kind of capabilities you want to do. We took an approach that we want to create pipelines that anyone can do it. That means we want a lean coding approach, low coding. We want a lot of automation. And we want to address the kind of 80% of the use cases out there of sourcing all of the mission critical data by just configuring, right? Just you create a manifest and configure where's your data, right? What kind of ways to get the data, how frequently you want to get the data, what does the shape look like? And then you describe and you ask them, what do you want to have this data in, right? What is the target? What kind of transformation that you want to do with this? And that is a configuration idea of just, hey, if you put all this stuff into some kind of run control, you know, process, then we can provision a pipeline automatically, right? We can start connecting the sources and pull the data through, help with the metadata identification, send the metadata to, say, some catalog for business use. Right? Business loves to use catalog to look at data. So we want to get that automation to them. We want to create a pipeline that can scale, so that depend on your data set. Is that, you know, 100,000 rows a day, or is that 1 million rows? So is that a terabytes of data that had to flow through this pipeline. So how do we scale those things for different pipelines in terms of workload isolation? How do we do that well? So those are the things that we're trying to make it easy by abstracting away all of the usual data engineering technology integration work into a data as a service infrastructure, right? And to provide that kind of self-service, the teams can actually get on and do some of this basic work very quickly, right? And get the data through. So now, if you're talking about used to be 6 months of building some platform and services to get the first service out, we'll be talking just a few weeks, right? Of provisioning and creating pipeline to get the data to flow through, right? And that's what we're talking about now is, at least the initial version we have is about 2 to 3 weeks, but over time we hope to make it even faster by creating additional features and automation so that teams can go in and do all this work without a lot of coding.
Yeah, I think a couple of things that you said in there as well that I'm hearing this of people who are being successful is that they're not trying to build their platform to cover absolutely every use case. There will be one-offs if there's something that's of value and it's of an insane scale, and that you don't want to, you know, you don't want to be, if people are doing serverless, that you're not doing something where you're doing, you know, a trillion transactions in a day. And so the cost is, you know, $50,000 a day or something, unless the money really makes sense, that ROI. But that 80% and those kind of sensible defaults and that like lowest friction to get something out of value. And that as something as the domains learn more about what data to share and how to share it, that they can get to, they can add incremental value, as well as the platform can evolve and start to cover more of those use cases and make it easier for them to add more value. But I think that's really important. I think the ones that I'm hearing are successful are the ones who kind of don't try to paint every corner, that they try to make it so this, and that you don't try and tackle, we're going to make it so that you can share this insanely complicated thing right up front. We're not going to try and tackle the hardest challenge first. We're building this muscle as we're adding value. You have to add value with everything you're doing, but it's also building that muscle and that learning.
Yeah, yeah, that's what we talk about too, right? Those words are building this muscle that we don't have, right? It's like, you know, you would think golf is a pretty easy sport, right? But you don't have that muscle to play golf, you're not going to last 18 holes. I mean, if you're like a, you know, tennis player, you have different muscle for tennis or football or soccer, right? But golf is to require different kind of muscle. So to build that kind of muscle is important. And to develop it the right way is also important, right? This is something that we over time learn how to help teams build up muscle and create this connective tissue. I know these are kind of things that seem to resonate with our upper management, but those connective tissue is so important. We cannot just have muscle out there that don't connect. It doesn't work, you know? And it's how do they function in a way that is productive, right? That has the least, exert the least amount of energy. So that is where a lot of lean coding thinking that we want to have. Automation is the type of muscle we want to use. We go into data ops and ML ops, right? Right away too, because we just think that, hey, DevOps has been fantastic. We learn a lot from it. But really in this space, we really think about data ops and ML ops. So that's just our journey right now.
Yeah, there's that, you know, people say practice makes perfect, and that's incorrect, because practice just hardens the muscle in the way that you're doing it. So if you're doing your practice wrong, then you're building the muscle in such a way and trying to unlearn that. I've had this with foreign language. My pronunciation was terrible. And so like trying to unlearn that, I just went, I can never be good at this language, because I learned how to read it and I learned how to say it in English phonetically, but not in the actual language. So it really didn't work.
Exactly. And sometimes it works to your advantage if you can figure out how to make it work. But at the same time, it's become a little bit of a hack, right? to make that muscle that doesn't work too well and add some more stuff around it to make it work is challenging. Yeah, the same thing with everything else. Right? We'll find ways for everything. Right? We're a very creative animal. Right? We can make everything work. The question is, does it work when you can, when you want to scale, right? When you want to go much higher and doing more, yeah, it's more challenging. But those are good points.
So you talked about the catalog, and that the businesses just want to go to a catalog. Yeah. And had an episode that came out that was talking about, kind of brought up the concept of data discovery not being only tooling based. I think in data mesh, there's still a tendency for people to try to solve every problem with a tool if they think the tool can solve it. How do you think about that? I mean, is it the 80-20 rule of, hey, we're going to solve 80% of the problem with the tooling because that's going to cost us 20% of the effort, and then we're going to solve the remaining 20% or as much as we can with people and process? Or how do you think about that, especially when it comes to maybe data discovery being an example of that? Because I know that's the challenge that I think everybody has in their top three, is that data discovery is really hard.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I know the traditional data catalog is something that business love to use. And I think we're not going to change that pretty quickly, at least in the short term. But I really think what we want to do is add something like a marketplace, a data marketplace, on top of these data pipelines and catalog and bring them together in a much more cohesive way, right? Something that are more friendly to business. And it could mean that we start looking at these as actually data products than just, like you say earlier, corporate asset. You just want to classify and doing things with it. You actually treat them as data products. I don't know if it's a good semaphore, but you know, you think of the Apple App Store, anything like that, right? There's certain, they revamp that over time, but definitely you want to have something that is more resonating with business users, including, hey, you know, can I get a quick sample of the data? What does it look like? Do I know all the people who use this data that I can talk to, right? Because sometimes I talk to IT, that might give me something that's so technical and so persuasive that I use it, but it's not really what I want. So do I have a kind of a red roots kind of reviews or something like that, that people can describe to me what they really found out and learned about the journey with this data as a product, right? What do you do in real life when you go buy something like a car, or you go and find somebody who can tell you about that car that you want to buy and explain it? So those are the things that we think business going to want to get to at some point. We may not have the technology to do that at the moment, but at least our thinking at Norton Trust is we're going to go to a data marketplace, right? We're going to use technologies to help them find data that they want to use and connect them with a community of people that use the data and provide feedback, right? Data products producers need feedback on data. So those are the things that we think that can make a very strong case for creating this kind of ecosystem for, you know, managing a very healthy and vibrant marketplace for consumers and producers to come together. So consumer can be business, can be IT, can be data scientists, producer can be any one of them too, right? If you really look at it that way at some point. At some point, anybody has anything good that would be useful, that would create, experience that people want to use and then help them with their whatever that they are looking to do with that data. That is the marketplace that we are really after. And that marketplace is a lot more than just a data catalog. It has to be.
Yeah, I think what you talked about of the word catalog is kind of what you said of just classifying. And so we need to move beyond that just a catalog versus, you know, you might also like, right, that you even have a recommendation engine within the data discovery of, hey, you're looking at this. Other people looked at this, and that you have that feedback, and that you have a data product producer being able to go out and say, hey, we're looking at adding this to our data set, right? Like, I don't know if your initial data products are tables or views or actual like data sets of multiple tables and things like that. But that if you think about, well, we're thinking about adding additionally to this data product, would anybody want this? Or here's what we're trying to get to. Is this going to be useful? So that we don't spend the effort, we don't spend the actual compute money and the time and effort to make sure that we can hit this quality level, or talking to people about what SLA do you need, right? Like, oh, you need this every day. We were going to put this with an SLA of 5 minutes, and that freshness SLA doesn't need to be there. Okay, then it's not nearly as compute intensive, and it's not as difficult to manage that quality level for, you know, especially if it's a large data set and things like that. So I think it's a lot of what you're talking about is something that keeps being a through line of just like enabling these conversations to take place, and that getting the data engineering team or whoever else, getting those people that have traditionally been the pass-throughs for these conversations out of the way, so that the actual direct producer and consumer can have the conversation. I mean, if you talk to product managers, I think the ones who are the best product managers are the ones who actually go and have lots of one-on-one conversations with consumers, right? So we need to do that as well with the data internally. So one thing you mentioned very early on was about having multiple customers. And that sounded like you were talking about internal customers, but are you also looking at this to back like applications for external customers, or are you doing that with partners or things like that? I'd love to jump into that. And then the other question I have is around managing interoperability. So whichever one sounds more interesting to jump into.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, the first one is easier. I like easy questions. Yeah, we have internal customers. External customers needs a little bit more. I guess part of it is presenting the data in ways that a lot more bespoke, a lot more customization. And all of our data eventually go to external customers, right? They have that's the way all these servicing business have. So there's usually another team at the edge that they do managing a lot of that client delivery kind of teams that use this kind of data from the mesh, and they create capabilities and make it fit for purpose, fit for use, fit for client needs, a very high touch kind of business. So we don't, at least my mandate right now is not to have data to go out of those, but there are teams that are doing that outside of this. And part of that's part of the current organization structure. So it fits perfectly, right? We don't have to do all those things. So it's nice that we don't have to deal with a lot of that at the edge right now. But to get the right data to them is critical, right? Because those guys have the same challenges of data wrangling, data massaging. They actually have their own data engineering at that end to do the work. So now if they don't have that, that even reduce, enable them to get things out faster to the clients. A smaller, more agile team to work with data. And you brought up a point about real time, right? A lot of people talk real time, but it's not that real time because there's so many teams that have to touch on the data and approve it before it get to anywhere. So it's not really that real time if you're talking about client deliveries. So with that, I'm going to just leave it that way, right? That, yeah, we have the data products can be used by multiple teams, and a lot of that has to do with meeting client needs, right? External clients' needs.
Yeah. Yes. I think that being able to make it so that those teams can more easily do that customization, but that customization also is kind of a persistent customization where it's not that, oh, I did my 10 transforms in the Excel spreadsheet and then now right. I don't know how to repeat that. Exactly. I've got that repeatability of being able to go, okay, here's what we did. And then I can push that back up to the producer. And either, you know, I have a query that I run, or that producer then goes, okay, we're going to also create this transformation in a data product so that you don't have to do these transformations yourself. Like, I think those are really helpful. So if you do need super bespoke for each customer, you probably don't want to have that as all part of one data product because it becomes bloat, but that you've got that capability.
Yeah. And I know this is a little bit of an endorsement of Snowflake here, but I think Snowflake is very good with data sharing, right? To get that to the edge and enable customer to sign up an account and be able to get data that we share. So that is a very good use of getting to, you know, data to the clients, right? Usually we do FTP or SFTP and dealing with that stuff and say, wow, you know. But with Snowflake, it's really do away with some of that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. That managing permissions is not fun. So one question that keeps coming up in a lot of these conversations is around interoperability. If you want to pass on trying to do the interoperability question, but like, how do you think about measuring the value of a data product in and of itself versus how much value it provides as kind of part of that greater marketplace concept? Are you starting with just, hey, we're trying to make this valuable in and of itself and we'll evolve towards that marketplace concept? Or are you trying to make things very interoperable? And how are you approaching interoperability? Is it universal ID or is it like... How do you think about
Yeah, that's has been always challenging because sometimes we get data from, you know, someone that we acquire, another company.
Yeah.
Or we get data from multiple legacy systems that don't have the same data structure. Even though it's the same key, but one system might have padded blanks, right? The other one is just like a different data type. So how do we deal with some of these things? You know, when it comes to that, you know, we try to stay a little bit truer to this whole bounded context thinking, right? And let the domain team define the data products that easier for them to manage. And yet, how do we describe this data so that if you want to join with someone else, there's a better way to do it? It's a little bit of an arts than a science, really, I think. because it down to teams talking to each other, right? Consumers and products. What is it that a producer should be building something that is compatible, that can interoperate with another data products in the marketplace? I don't know if we're at that point yet. I think that's going to be a journey by its own. It's kind of learning along the line. And I think this is the part that at some point, the easy ones we can do will be pretty quick to get done. But the harder one, especially when it comes to legal entities, right, parties, when you get to MDM, stuff like that, that is where a lot of those things kind of start coming out, I think. I think that's where a lot of the work has to be done there to really help with the interoperability aspect of it. Yeah.
So it sounds like, if I'm summing you up, that it's, you've been focusing more on creating high quality data products in and of themselves versus the greater mesh concept, but that you're kind of talking with people about, hey, we have to evolve this as we get towards, we need to have that interoperability. We need to have that ability to combine the data that, if we don't have that in the long run, that hurts us. But in the short run, it's better to have quality data products that are out there rather than not.
That's about right.
Right. And that we're not letting that interoperability be a gating factor to us.
Yeah, because it's a difficult problem to solve right away. And we know that is something needed. But we, you know, one thing that we adamant about, Scott, is all the data goes into our data mesh has to have this temporality in it, right? It's bitemporal, right? The two set of timestamp, what is the effective from and to, and what is the transaction or system timestamp when it's recorded from and to. Those are the things that enable us to look back at the data or look in the present and understand how we can treat this data. I think that's the heart of, that is something that is more important than the interoperability right now, because a lot of the data joining, we can massage the key when we join for sure, right? May not be efficient, but joining with the right data, with the temporal aspect of it, is a lot harder, right? And you don't have that. You don't have that bitemporal in place. You're not going to be able to do it at all. So we kind of pick the one that we think that this is going to be more value added as part of our governance. So this is getting into governance here, right? Interoperability, security, ability to manage our data sets, versioning, and all of those things is part of the governance thing that we kind of lay out, right? This is an MVP 1.0. We have to have these three out of these seven things we want to do, and we implement those three things. Right? And then hopefully next year, or this year actually, we'll get to the other two that are important for data security, for fine-grained security at column and row, to enable us to figure out who used the data, what is the user behavior analytics, to know that, hey, Scott went to, you know, say another country in Canada, right? From that IP address, from that region, he's trying to pull this much data out. Why is that? Do we have ability to track those things? So those are the things that is more important to us, that now we have data, we want to know who used it, where and when, and how do we block some of these things, right? Because in a bank, we are very concern about data security. So those are the things that we implement first as part of the governance.
Yeah, and I think that's something that I've been talking about as well with pilots of like people let governance really be a big blocker for them. And I think what you want to do with your pilot is to make sure that you're not putting yourself in a bad spot and that you're not trying to solve all of governance. So you might have tighter security controls than you want, but that you go, okay, like we're going to make this so that the domain can say this is PII and basically no one gets access to that at all by default, and that they have to go and there is a formal process for them to get access to that, and that we're not saying we're going to grant it to this role but not this role and this. You just start with, hey, we're going to say, is this widely accessible or is this not? And if it's not, then you have that manual process, and that's fine to have as you move towards scalability, right? It's that you don't have to figure everything out ahead of time. You have to set yourself up not to get in trouble, but that outside of that, your governance needs to be an enabling factor instead of a blocking factor, and that's far easier said than done.
Yeah, picking the right governance, like you say, is important, right? If you take all seven of them, you pick the three that are not the good ones, you end up, not getting what you want. So yeah, governance needed, but we don't have to tackle all of them at once. Yeah. That's a key thing that you just say there. And we try to do that.
So this has been great, but we're kind of coming up on an hour here. We're fast approaching that. But really does. Is there anything that we didn't cover today that you think would be really interesting for folks or really usable for folks, useful that they, as people are going along their own journey, like some, I'm asking you for the silver bullet learning, which there is no silver bullet to data mesh, but is there something that you think was really interesting or useful or even just kind of funny that might be a good thing to wrap up on?
Yeah. I think one of the things that you do this, if you do this, you have to be passionate about it, right? You're not doing it because it's like the newest thing out there. You have to be passionate about data. And also be lighthearted too, the journey the stories is still being written, right? It's a long journey. I try to find definitely it can be very confusing. You go into different, groups, especially I use a lot of vendors and talk to a lot of them, but you have to distill the information and disseminate them so that you can get something useful out of it. And then figure out how it's going to work for your organization, right? Not just because something works somewhere else. You cannot just bring into your organization it's going to work. That's number one. Number two is I think that you have to find something that resonates with a lot of people. One thing that Laura and I did that very early on when we did this last year is think of it as building a commercial kitchen, right, with multiple stations. And you want these people to be able to go in and bring help them bring the ingredients, right, whether spices or chicken or lobster. You have to make sure you have refrigerator to put all those things in, or catalog them all, give them the station if they want to cook this. If you cook in Chinese style, you need a wok. If you want to make a pizza, you need a pizza oven. So those are the things that you want to create a kind of a master chef kitchen with all these things. And this guy just come in and just cook and help create these creations. And if the creation doesn't, the judge or someone doesn't like it, they can create again. You have to give them that environment, kind of an incubator environment to try things out. Otherwise, that would be very difficult for them to go in and do things with you, right? So you really had to give them that capability to do it. I really think that is one thing that we don't want to lose sight is at the end of the day, with the data mesh concept, the construct is to get the data custodian, right? The people that has to work with the data engineering, to make it easier for them to do things, right? And create products that if they fail fast and they create another one and match them up with the consumer, or a consumer can find them and use their products. And I think that kind of create that whole, you know, stickiness, right? I guess that whole ecosystem flowing, that now I have products that people want to use, I can create another one, a derivative products that someone else might use that, you know. So those are the things that are important to think about, making it easy for people to use. Yeah. Not just because it's cool, right? I have great technology that can solve this. No, it's about enable people to do things. So enabling is the important part.
Yeah, that giving room for failure, I think, is something where a lot of people are getting stuck on trying to do their POC, where they go, I can't fail with this. And it's like, you want to set yourself up for success, but you also want to give people that experimentation space where they can experiment and that it's not the end of the world. And so I'm still trying to figure out how to work with people to let them do kind of like a spec data product or things like that. How do we actually make this so that somebody can get that feedback and try something out, and that it is, exactly. It's not that they went and they spent, you know, hours and hours cooking this thing versus like, hey, I'm going to whip up the sauce. Is the sauce any good? Like I'm going to
get a little taste of it. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a key thing, right? How do you do this well and get the feedback a little bit quicker than trying to go too far? And then it's not exactly what people want. How do you go about doing something like that? And the only way to do it is to give them, you know, a place to try and do things. I think that's key to success. Where about in that journey, right? We just started out with an incubator area where people can go in and look at all the products, look at ways they can bring their own ingredients and cook them and doing things like that. We're right in the middle of that journey, is to start that enabling process right now.
Well, Juan Rosiers, when he was at DPG, talked about this, about there are things that aren't even, that they're listed and they're discoverable, but aren't considered data mesh data products. They're not domain data products because they're not high quality enough, but people can get a sense of, there are these ingredients. Do you want us to make these available in such a way that they're of high enough quality that they are food grade, right? Right now they're not food grade. So how do we make it so that they are food grade and ensure that they're food grade? So I like that concept as well of like, it's not that the domain just says, here is our data on the outside. It's like, here's the data that's kind of on the threshold. Is there something where we should share from this? Is there this stuff that people really want and that people can start, that the consumers can come to them and let them know as well?
Exactly. And Scott, you asked, I think you maybe have brought this up in other podcasts, but I think that there's way too many of this. Hey, is this a data mesh? Or is that a data fabrics or data vault and all of these different things, right? And people get so stuck on some of this that they cannot move forward. They do so much analysis on it. I think the data mesh is different because it encourages people to go and do things, right? And to enable people, hey, you know that all these pain points, let's do something different and think differently. And that is more important than the technical part of it.
Well, and people in data, in IT in general, but especially in data, have been sold vendor-based selling, and that it's, here is the solution and it is my technology and here is the blueprint on exactly how to do this. So people can get a little frustrated around data mesh because there isn't that blueprint, because it is very much adapt to your org, and here's what you're trying to achieve. And what I'm trying to get from the podcast and the community is, how are people attempting to achieve that? And what's working and what's not. And so that way we can all iterate together and kind of have that same thing of a place where it's safe to fail, where it's safe to put out, here's what we're trying. Because if we're overly criticizing people and their efforts, it's going to lead for people to not want to share, versus if we can all say, hey, here's my crazy idea. Does this make any sense?
and that, that we can have those dialogues. It's very important. So, this has been super awesome. Really love the conversation here. I think this is going to have a lot of useful nuggets for people to kind of take out for their own journey, especially kind of the last two is what I took down was you can't copy paste from other organizations and you need to create that. You need to find the things that resonate and give people the ability to experiment and fail fast, and that you make failing safe, and that you make that something that's okay, and that's part of the learning journey. So where can people find you? What do you want people following up with you about? Just LinkedIn or Twitter?
LinkedIn is the best way to find me. And I'd be more than happy to hear feedback and hear more stories. And Scott, you know, I just want to quickly say that every podcast you guys have has been different kind of nuggets and insights, right? It's something that everybody need to listen sometime a couple of times and just, hey, actually, what does Juan talk about knowledge graph here, right? And just start understanding that and say, well, that is where you want to be down the road, kind of things. Or if someone like Max sharing, you know, his second year journey, you can hear that, hey, you know, this is not something you can do overnight, right? Yeah. And that's amazing. So those are things that I think I just want to say that what you guys are doing here is fantastic. It's going to help the data community to move forward and find a better way to do things faster and maybe a little bit cheaper, right? Or more manageable.
I keep trying to tell people that like the whole idea of the community is that if everybody's doing this alone in the dark, it's going to take 5-7 years versus originally when I launched the community in last February, it was, oh, I think we'll be able to get to the answers in 18 months. And now we're 12 months in and I'm like, okay, it's going to take 24 months. So is it going to be 36 months next February that I'm thinking? But that it means that we can iterate towards this in a faster way. We can talk about what works and what approaches don't. So I'm really appreciative of people like yourself that are sharing your excellent context and information. So, again, Con, thank you so much for your time and thank you everybody for listening.
I'd again like to thank my guest today, Con Chow, the lead architect for the Data Mesh Initiative at Northern Trust. As always, you can find his contact information in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Data Mesh Radio. Hopefully it was useful to you. If you'd like to connect with the show, you can find us on LinkedIn or Twitter. If you'd like to connect with me, you can do the same. If you have feedback, or especially if you'd like to be a guest, we've got some links in the show notes to tell you how to do that. We'd love to hear what questions people have and how I can be useful. And then this is provided as a free community resource by DataStax. So please do stick around after the music if you'd like to hear more about what DataStax is offering with their serverless managed version of Cassandra. Data Mesh Radio is a free community resource provided by DataStax. If you're not aware, I'm actually employed by DataStax, and they've allowed me to be a resource for the general data community, learning about data mesh, data as a product, and other related topics. If you're not aware, DataStax has made a lot of pretty big, interesting changes in the last few years. They now offer a multi-region, very performant, serverless database offering with a number of easy to develop for APIs with like gRPC, JSON, GraphQL, REST. You know, if you'd like to learn more, check them out. You can check out their AstroDB offering, and you can use the code DAAP500. That's DAAP500. Or data as a product 500 to get $500 of free credits. You can also check out what they're doing with streaming. It's pretty interesting.